The purpose of today's call is really to provide in-depth insights into the legal agreement that is used as the basis for the relationship among participants in the eHealth Exchange. Joining me today is Steve Gravely. He is the healthcare practice group leader at Troutman Sanders and was instrumental in facilitating the development of the DRSA. So we're very pleased to have Steve here today to really help set the stage for the DRSA, the context of the DRSA in and of itself, as well as doing an in-depth review of the key provisions. What we thought we'd do is start today with spending some time setting the context regarding the eHealth Exchange and some assumptions and context regarding the DRSA itself, and then really spend a good deal of time delving into the details of the provisions of the DRSA. We are going to leave some time at the end for plenty of questions. We do ask the group to please hold questions to the end. So looking at slide 3, the eHealth Exchange, for those of you who may not be familiar with this group, the eHealth Exchange is really a community of exchange partners who securely share information over the Internet with each other, and they do so using a common set of standards and technical specifications and policies. And what binds the participants to each other is a trust agreement called the Data Use and Reciprocal Support Agreement. And by signing the DRSA, participants agree to comply with these common rules of the road, these common set of standards and technical specifications and policies. Now, the eHealth Exchange is really a construct of really participants exchanging data with each other. This effort is overseen by a committee called the Coordinating Committee, and that's really the group that's responsible for making sure that participants comply with the DRSA and also fulfilling specific set of responsibilities laid out in the legal agreement for things that they need to do. HealthyWay is a nonprofit organization that really powers the eHealth Exchange, and by that we mean that we actually support participants and the coordinating committee through a number of ways. And for instance, we help maintain the rules of the road that participants comply with, including changes to technical specifications and policies and even the DRSA itself. HealthyWay also supports the coordinating committee as it deliberates and we implement the decisions that the committee makes. We also facilitate task groups that develop and maintain the technical requirements and operating policies and procedures, as well as testing requirements. And we have also are responsible for establishing both an HAE product certification program, but also a participant testing program so that they can onboard to the eHealth Exchange. There are also two pieces of shared infrastructure that HealthyWay maintains. One relates to issuing and managing digital certificates that participants use to authenticate to each other so that they know if someone else has an eHealth Exchange participant that they can trust with them and share data with them securely. And we also manage a directory, sort of like the Yellow Pages, that allows eHealth Exchange participants to find others. The important thing we wanted to mention here is that HealthyWay is not a middleman. We're not a party to the exchange. No data flows through HealthyWay servers. In fact, we don't touch the data or the records that are exchanged. We're not a gateway or connection point. Rather, we're really the support organization for the participants and the coordinating committee. If you go to slide 4, there are currently today 15 of 40 eHealth Exchange participants are in production, with the latest addition is the Veterans Health Administration. And what that means is this group really demonstrated an early commitment to help shepherd the eHealth Exchange as HealthyWay assumed responsibility from ONC to really help sustain and start up HealthyWay. And so we just do want to acknowledge the incredible support that they've provided in really guiding us to this place where we are today. So today there are 40 participants in the eHealth Exchange, a very diverse group of both governmental and private organizations. Today in production there are 4 federal agencies, 6 states, 8 beacon communities, and with a mix of also private HIOs and health systems. And the next slide is the eHealth Exchange is undergoing dramatic growth, and we see participation in the eHealth Exchange really reaching critical mass. So if we look at those 40 participants, those nodes in the eHealth Exchange, it really represents and translates to more than 800 hospitals who are currently exchanging data today, about 10,000 physician practices, hundreds of million patient records, and actually today there are about 120 more organizations in various stages of preparing to onboard. There is a national level coverage that's increasing. We have a footprint in all 50 states. Data are actively traversed 23 states today. And we're seeing that this momentum is really building. It's spurred in part with our collaboration with the Care Connectivity Consortium. We have these five pinnacle health systems, very innovative group, who are joining the eHealth Exchange and together will help serve as an innovation partner as we continue to advance and enhance the services that we use to support the eHealth Exchange. We're also seeing dramatic growth driven by Stage 2 meaningful use. And many of you are coming forward with an interest in earning credit toward the Stage 2 measures, and by participating in or connecting through an eHealth Exchange participant, you can actually earn credit toward the very important measures. So the impetus here and for the purpose of today's call is because we are working with so many groups who may not have been familiar with the early work in developing the DRSA, we wanted to use the opportunity today to really set the context and do this this deep dive. If you look at slide 7, one of the things that's helpful to lay out early on is the relationships between the participants in the eHealth Exchange and those who are connected through participants. So the lion's share of participants today also connect multiple other organizations or groups of users. And so we wanted to use this as an opportunity to kind of explain the relationships of these and the type of trust framework that we assume is in place and that we leverage and assume exists. The intent here is to, and the participants realize that by signing the DRSA, they have a very clear understanding of what other signatories are bound to. But it was a little unclear in the early days about how you would obligate other organizations who connect to the participant or their users, who may be once or twice removed from the connection, to maintain that chain of trust. And so this shows that if there is a participant is an HIE or an intermediary, the assumption was that they likely already had participant agreements with the organizations that connected to them, and subsequently the organizations who connect to them would have end-user license agreements or terms of use or other policies that obligate their users to appropriately use the connectivity and just be good stewards of the system and have good security practices. Similarly, if a participant is a governmental agency, the assumption is that they themselves had mechanisms in place to obligate any other participating agencies or their end users to appropriately use the connectivity, and whether that was through policies or training or agreements in and of themselves. And finally, in the instance where a participant is an integrated delivery network, the assumption was that there were likely employment agreements or policies in place with users that we could leverage these existing legal agreements and policies as a mechanism to assure that the obligations in the DRSA flowed down to those who were also had access to and used the connectivity. So we thought we'd walk through slides 8 and 9 and 10, how this sort of translates, and to understand the roles that participants and their users play in the exchange of data via the eHealth Exchange. So slide 8 shows a scenario where one participant user, say it's a physician, requests records from another provider, and they're both connected to different participant organizations. And in the DRSA, there are terms that are used to describe the responsibilities of those who submit information and those who receive information. And so in this scenario, provider B initiates a request for records, and they submit that request to another participant, and it goes to participant A, the user. And in that instance, participant A is the recipient of the request. And so there's certain duties that participant B, user, has to fulfill as the submitter of that request, and there are certain expectations of participant A as the recipient of that request. So this is what it looks like and when the request is initiated. Slide 9 illustrates how the roles shift a little bit when participant A user responds to the request for data. And in this instance, when they respond to the message by releasing the records or saying records not found, they are submitting that response to the participant B user who is receiving it. And again, the responsibilities again shift to the party who submits the data versus who receives it. And so that's how this plays out when an organization responds to requests for documents. similar to that scenario is a scenario where there's an unsolicited push of information, a push of records from participant A to participant B. And in this case, maybe it's a report or quality reporting or clinical data. In this case, participant A submits the data and participant B is the recipient. And we'll go into a little bit more detail about what the obligations are for submitters and recipients. In that respect, I will turn it over now to Steve Gravely to provide additional context regarding the DRSA and to drill down into the details of the provisions. So Steve, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you, Mary Ann, and good afternoon or good morning to everyone who's on our call, depending on where you happen to be. Mary Ann, that was a great overview and very efficient overview of the eHealth Exchange. As Mary Ann noted, I've had the privilege of being involved with eHealth Exchange since really it's almost its beginnings as a trial implementation project from ONC, and was asked, along with Holt Anderson from Inchica, who many of you probably know, to co-chair what was affectionately called the DRSA work group. And from there, one thing has led to another, and here we are. It's still astounding to me every time I hear Mary Ann go through the slides just at the tremendous growth and success that eHealth Exchange has accomplished and is continuing to accomplish. And it's just a very exciting time for all of us. So what I've been asked to do in the next, probably 45 to 50 minutes is to walk folks through the DRSA. And I do want to just say a couple of things at the start. I'm going to assume that most of you have at least seen the document and read it. If you haven't, then you'll get some background on this call, but you it won't be some of this may not make a whole lot of sense to you. This is being recorded, and so I would recommend that if you've never actually seen the document, you go ahead and listen to this webinar. Go read the document and then maybe listen to a recording, and you'll probably, things will be a little bit more clear for you. So let's go to slide 12, if we can, Jennifer. So what is the DRSA? Well, at its core, the DRSA is a contract. It's a multi-party trust agreement that binds together in a legally enforceable way any organization that wants to participate, be a capital P participant in the eHealth Exchange. I would say the DRSA absolutely was a first of its kind document. Since the very first version of the DRSA back in 07, there have been a lot of multi-party trust agreements, most of which actually use the DRSA as a starting point, which all of us who worked on it, are very, very pleased by. So today, the idea of a multi-party trust agreement is not really a novel idea, but when we first sat down in 05, I guess it was, with a blank slate, it was a very novel idea. And we had a lot of really dedicated folks, both technology and business and legal, on the work group, and came out with what I think has been a pretty useful document. Before that, the data exchange world was defined by point-to-point agreements, and certainly as a percentage of transactions, that's still the predominant model even today. But I think everyone recognizes that point-to-point agreements are not sustainable when we start to talk about things like population health. It simply isn't scalable in a way that is practical. And so the DRSA was one solution to that, in which we could create a flexible but binding legal agreement that would allow folks to exchange information with some confidence that they were doing so in a legally compliant manner. The at its core, just like every contract, there are certain requirements that those who sign the document are committing to follow. And we're going to walk through the major ones today. And if you sort of come away with nothing else today from the call, I hope you'll come away with a sense that what the DRSA does is, through a legally binding contract, it creates a framework, a trust framework, for the safe and secure exchange of health information. Now, I will be the first to say that the DRSA, by itself, could not do that. It is a tool that that is an important part of the larger trust framework that is created by the commonality of interest of those who want to exchange information, by the coordinating committee, which the DRSA actually created and defines, and by the entire community that wants to be part of a trust community. The DRSA is an essential tool, but isn't in and of itself the answer. And I think that's really a very important point for everyone to understand. Another point I want to make is that the DRSA, while it is a contract, it really never, we don't view it as ever being completely settled and final. Now, for the lawyers on the call, their ears just perked up. So let me be real clear about what I'm saying. The DRSA that's been signed by all the participants is certainly complete and binding and is given in exchange of mutual consideration and is enforceable. However, the environment for health data exchange is rapidly evolving, and concepts that we were talking about 5 years ago, we're no longer talking about, and things that we are doing weren't even on the board 5 years ago. So the challenge for the coordinating committee and for HealthyWay and for me and for others who work in this space is to constantly be looking for ways in which the DRSA might need to be revised and amended to keep pace with the new environment. Now, that is not a simple process. Because of our federal participants, we have to go through federal clearance every time we amend the DRSA, which is, for those of you who have been through it, it's extremely rigorous and time-consuming. I don't think that's a bad thing, because that assures that there will not be any casual revisions to this very foundational document. But it absolutely is capable of being amended. It has been amended, and I'm sure that it will be in the future. Let's go on to slide 13. So real quickly, just a couple of important terms. These are all defined in the DRSA, and there are some other terms that we'll be talking about as we walk through the agreement. But I'm going to run down through these very quickly. Applicable law. This is an extremely elastic concept. As you can understand, with five federal agencies and over 40 participants and more coming on all the time from throughout the 54 states and territories that constitute the United States, we have a lot of laws that apply. HIPAA, sure, of course. Privacy Act of 1974 for the federal agencies, FISMA, the Federal Information Security Management Act for the federal agencies, state laws, tribal laws, and the list goes on and on. So rather than try and boil the ocean and come up with the definitive reconciliation of all those laws, which I think if we tried to do that, we would still be on page one of the document, the DRSA group decided that we would go with this concept of applicable law, which basically means every participant is expected to comply with the law that applies to them. They're already doing that, and it doesn't really require any new infrastructure. And so that was seen as eliminating a hurdle that prior to that had been pretty insurmountable in terms of trying to reconcile the irreconcilable. And surprisingly, we haven't really had a lot of problems with that. I'm sure at some point, there will be issues, but so far it's worked pretty well. And so that's a very important concept. And it tries to incorporate the fact that there is a diverse and ever-changing body of law, both at the state level and the federal level, that governs health information, the transaction of that information through electronic media, and folks are required to comply with that, and the DIRS is not trying to create a new standard. When we talk about messages, a message is simply an electronic transmission between or among participants that use the specifications that have been adopted by the coordinating committee. The message content is actually the information in that message. There are various analogies that people use. You probably have your own, but I think now this is fairly a standard the terminology that folks are familiar with. A participant, of course, is anyone that is a signatory to the DIRSA. Participant users are, as a schematic that Marianne talked about, you saw that graphically. Those are folks who are either under contract to or are employed by a participant who are authorized to use eHealth Exchange for the purpose of transacting message content through that participant's system. So it's a fairly straightforward concept. Permitted purposes, this was a very important one and one that the DIRSA group struggled with, but the DIRSA actually identifies the purposes for which message content may be transacted using eHealth Exchange. And I believe we have a slide on that later. It is more narrow than HIPAA, and that's a very important concept, but it's still pretty broad. Performance and service specs, as you can see here from the slide, these are technical specifications that have been adopted by the coordinating committee. Those are incorporated by reference into the DIRSA and are binding on all those who sign it. And we're going to talk about that later in terms of how those get amended and revised over time. As Marianne pointed out, a submitter is someone who submits message content to a recipient for a permitted purpose. And then transact is simply the activity of that message flowing through the system. Okay, let's go to slide 14. Now, basic premises, these are really, really important, and they continue to inform the coordinating committee even today as the coordinating committee begins to consider new and emerging models of participants that maybe weren't thought about at the time that the DIRSA was written. But the basic premises that underlie the DIRSA can be reduced to these five bullet points. First of all, the DIRSA assumes that every participant has in place trust relationships with those that access its system, whether they're agents or employees, whether they're HSP providers or vendors. Every participant has its own unique world, and it interacts with all sorts of folks. And so the DIRSA assumes that the participant has in place legally compliant trust relationships with those folks. And DIRSA actually states that. And that's one of the flowdowns that we're going to talk about here in a little bit. Every participant must comply with applicable law. As I've already said, every participant must comply with the HIPAA privacy and security rules. And it's interesting, but when we first sat down to do the DIRSA, the prevailing assumption among all the legal counsel, was that most of the participants wouldn't be covered by HIPAA because they weren't covered entities, and at the time they weren't business associates. Now, of course, that's all changed with high tech and with the final rule. But it's just interesting to point out how things evolve in a very short amount of time. So in the DIRSA, what you see is that if you're a covered entity or a business associate of a covered entity, then of course you're covered, you have to comply with HIPAA privacy and security rules. But if you are not, then by contract, you are agreeing to comply with those by signing the DIRSA. Again, that's a section that we may take out in our next revision because the law has now evolved past that. But the concept was that we were setting the HIPAA privacy and security standards as the floor and encouraging folks to go beyond that, but setting that as an absolute floor. And I think that's part of the trust framework. You may or may not have seen some of the presentations that Marianne and I did a few years ago on the trust framework. If not, I would encourage you to try to find those, where we talk about the fact that one of the essential elements of a trust community is that there be a common set of rules and that everyone know what they are and know that everyone else in the community is bound by the same rules. This is a good example of how the DRSA carries that forward into specific contract language by setting a specific, knowable, identifiable floor for conduct. The next bullet is that the coordinating committee provides the oversight of eHealth Exchange and thereby supporting the participants. Now, again, there was no coordinating committee in the beginning, and eHealth Exchange is not anything that's been legislated. It's not anything that has its own independent legal authority. It is an activity, a consensual activity among willing participants. And so the coordinating committee is a great example of self-governance. And some of you who have been around a while probably remember AHIC, the precursor to NEHIC, and some of the work that Marianne and I and many others did on the concepts of governance. And one of the fundamental principles there was consent of the governed. And the coordinating committee is really the manifestation of that concept. The DRSA creates the coordinating committee, identifies its powers, identifies its composition, and by signing the DRSA, the participants are agreeing to submit themselves to the authority of the coordinating committee. So it is a pure example of self-governance by contract. And so that's a very important concept and one that was, I think now has been widely adopted, but at the time was fairly novel. And another important premise is that it will be up to the participants to decide how they want to interact with eHealth Exchange. There's not a mandatory flow down necessarily. It is more the DRSA tries to accommodate folks who are different places on their evolutionary journey with eHealth Exchange and be a supporting tool as opposed to an obstacle that has to be overcome. So let me move on and pick up the pace a bit. Let's go to slide 15. Performance and service specs. Well, so as I said before, every participant will identify to Marianne and her staff and ultimately in their application the transaction patterns that they are going to support. For every transaction pattern, the participant is going to have to decide whether they are a data submitter, a data recipient, or both. And at that point, they will, depending upon the role that the participant identifies for themselves, they will then be subject to the specs, the performance and service specifications that are applicable to that type of activity. And so there's a core set of mandatory specifications that apply to everyone. And then there are additional specifications that have been developed and will continue to be developed that will support additional transaction patterns. And the DRSA expressly incorporates the performance and service specifications by reference and makes them binding, although they exist in a separate document. Because they do need to be changed more frequently than the DRSA itself. And we have a change process that I believe we're going to be able to chat about. If not, there's a very detailed change process in the DRSA so that this is not something that happens out of the sight of the participants, but it is easier to change the specs than it is to amend the DRSA. And so very intentionally, and I think very wisely, the work group decided to follow that model in order to give the DRSA more flexibility, which we have absolutely needed in the intervening years. Let's go to slide 16. The same concept applies to what we call OPMPs, operating policies and procedures. And these are different from specs. These are more business-related and operations-related as opposed to purely technical. And there are, I'm not sure what the number of OPMPs is today, maybe 10 or 12 at this point. The coordinating committee adopts them, and they address very important things such as, who's qualified to be a participant? What's the definition of an eligible participant? What are the requirements specific requirements when you're transacting message content. What type of support is in place for participants? And some of these OPMPs apply purely to the coordinating committee in terms of how does it conduct its business and what rules does it follow. And so you have sort of inward-looking OPMPs and outward-looking OPMPs. And, again, those are incorporated by reference. They are fully binding on participants. There is a defined process for changing them so that folks are not caught off guard. But they are expected, they are designed to be more flexible and change more often than the DRSA itself. Again, a very intentional approach and one that I think has served us quite well. Let's go on to slide 17 and talk about the flowdowns. This is a topic that I know has generated a lot of discussion among folks who are aspiring to be participants and those who are participants. When they first read the DRSA, and they tend to focus in on these two sections, 15.04 and 15.05, the so-called flowdown provisions. So I'm going to talk through these, and then I'm going to turn, in the next two slides, then I'm going to turn it over to Mary Ann, and she's going to chat with you folks about some of the practical guidance that her office has been giving to participants as they, you know, sometimes, in some cases, wrestle with how to accomplish the flowdowns. So the important point here is that the DRSA very squarely puts the burden on each participant to make certain that their users, their participating organizations, and their technology partners, if there are any, comply with the flowdown provisions. So it is a very intentional and purposeful contractual requirement to impose on the participants specific obligations. And it was written that way to acknowledge the fact that eHealth Exchange then, and frankly still today, and I think probably forever, is not going to get into the participant's business. It's not going to try to micromanage the way that each participant conducts its affairs. That's impractical and I believe would be pretty poorly received by most every participant. And so the alternative that was settled on by the work group was to impose that obligation on each participant and say, okay, if you are a health information organization, you are expected to have ways in which to enforce the provisions of the DRSA so that the coordinating committee can be comfortable that it is not contracting with simply an empty shell, just to put it bluntly. And because the first time that happens, then you destroy all trust in the network. And one of the, you know, that's simply too dear a price to pay because that would really undercut the entire trust fabric. And so I know that these provisions have caused some angst among many of you on the call and many of you who will be listening, but there was a lot of thought that went into this, a lot of debate, a lot of argument in some cases, and so that's sort of the history. Now, let's drill down a little bit on what these are. So if we look at Section 15.04 of the DRSA, and this is not a verbatim reproduction of the section, but it will suffice for purposes of our talk today. What the DRSA requires is that the participant, either through contract or policy, procedure, or some other means, we're not prescriptive in how you do it, but the participant has to assure that its users, its participating organizations, and their users comply with applicable law. Again, not a heavy lift. And really something that the participant's going to have to be doing anyway under HIPAA and probably under state law. Also, that that those users and sub-organizations cooperate with the participant on issues related to the DRSA. And this comes up a lot of different ways, but probably the example that most folks resonate with is dealing with potential or suspected breaches. And we're going to talk about breach a little later. But again, in trying to design a trust community, I would say the fear of a breach was one of the great boogeymen in the room, for good reason. And so the DRSA work group, you know, tackled that head on. The coordinating committee has tackled that head on and said, okay, sure, there is a risk here. And so one of the flowdowns is that even if you're not the organization that signs the DRSA, if you work with that organization, then the group, the organization that signed the DRSA is going to flow down to you a reasonable duty of cooperation, and just in case, you know, we need to work together to resolve an issue that comes up. We flow down permitted purposes. I think that's probably obvious, but as I said before, the e-health exchange permitted purposes are narrower than HIPAA. They are also a heck of a lot broader than the treatment-only permitted purposes that a lot of HIOs have adopted. And so I would say they are in the middle, so to speak, and on the broad side of the middle, perhaps. And so participants that sign the DRSA are required to flow those down to their users and others, because we want to be sure that there are no structural impediments to message content being transacted. Obviously, there's a flowdown about the use of the data in accordance with the DRSA. There's a flowdown of the breach notification provisions. We're going to talk about those in detail shortly. And then there's a flowdown of, you know, protecting passwords and security measures, which, again, should be a no-brainer, but it's certainly critical. And, again, you have to remember this was written, you know, pre-high-tech and pre-final rule. So some of this has been reinforced or even superseded by evolutions in the law. Section 1505 is a parallel provision, but it applies to a participant's technology partners, folks from whom the participant may purchase services. And I will say that at the time the DRSA was written, the cloud was just really beginning to emerge. I know it's hard to believe now, but because it seems like the cloud's been with us forever, but it really hasn't. At least not in the way that it is now in healthcare. And so we did not write this section with the cloud in mind, but I think the cloud's a great example of why this is important, because many, if not most, HIOs today are involved in a software as a service model. They are purchasing hosting services from their technology partner for at least some period of time. And so... And I can't claim that any of us in the work group were visionaries and saw this coming, but we did understand that we had to somehow be sure that the technology partners that were servicing our participants were somehow contractually obligated to support the participants' obligations under the DRSA. So we have the flowdown provisions in 1505 for the technology partners in terms of compliance with applicable law, protecting the privacy and security of message content, breach notification, and reasonable cooperation. And as I said, in a cloud-based world, I think those are even more important than they were at the time that we wrote them. Let's move on to Section 18 and continue to talk about, you know, how you implement the flowdown provisions. And I'm going to talk about this, you know, from a legal perspective, and then Marianne will pick it up and talk about it from the perspective of the advice that she and her group have been giving to applicants. I don't know if there are really any participants anymore that don't have some type of enforceable agreement with their users or their subcontractors or their sub-participant organizations. But if not, they need to develop those. We know that a number of folks took the DRSA and used that as a model for their agreements, which is fine. There are many important differences, but, and again, it's not the job of the coordinating committee, nor have we attempted to review those or anything. I think that for organizations that do not have those in place, they certainly have to put them in place. For those that do have existing agreements in place, they're going to want to review those to make sure that they can be used to effectively flow down the DRSA provisions, because by signing the DRSA, you're agreeing to this contractually, and it is a representation and a warranty. I certainly encourage everyone to involve their legal department. I realize not everyone has an in-house legal department, and you know, the extent to which you engage outside counsel and incur expense, obviously that's got to be an individual decision. But I do think that it may be money and time well spent in terms of making sure that your legal counsel understands what the flow-down provisions are and can give you an opinion that you have the measures in place to do that. You may have to amend your existing agreements, or if you don't have them, you're going to probably have to create them. And so I think that that is a, you know, that's why counsel is probably very important here, so that they are not, you know, in the dark, and this doesn't hit their desk, and then suddenly, you know, they're sort of flying around trying to figure out what's going on. I've been in that position, and it's not a comfortable place to be. You very well may need to establish some training programs for your users or your sub-participant organizations. And when I say that, you know, think about a regional HIO or a community-based HIO that, where all the local hospitals and health systems and physicians are participants. There are, and then within those organizations, there are individuals, physicians, nurses, folks in the billing office, and others who are individual users. But your sub-participants would be the folks that you have your data sharing agreements with through your HIO. You may very well have to do some training about eHealth Exchange and what the rules of the road are, much like many of you have done when you've adopted a new system. And there's not only technical training, but also training around what the rules of the road are. And some of the vendors even call their online sharing communities that, rules of the road. You may have to update some of your internal policies and procedures, some of your forms, et cetera. I'm not going to, you know, I'm certainly not going to suggest that there is no work to be done. But so far, we don't really think that that's been a showstopper for anyone that has tried to onboard. And you are going to have to provide evidence that if you weren't ready at the time of your application and you presented a plan for readiness, you're going to have to show that that plan has been implemented prior to go live. And with that, I'm going to turn the next slide over to Mary Ann for her to walk through some of the advice that she and her group have been providing.
Well, thank you, Steve. As you can imagine, there have been a number of questions regarding how to interpret and understand what's expected regarding the flow-down expectations. And so there's actually a question in the application for participation, question number 8, I believe it is today, that asks applicants to explain how they actually address with each of the flow-down provisions. And this is an area where we found that there tend to be a lot of questions, and we thought we'd take this opportunity to just share what we have been communicating and use this as an opportunity also to let you all know that we are in the process of developing more detailed guidance. This is actually fairly straightforward. I think once we walk through this, it'll maybe help help you understand what is really different from what you may already have in place today. So in the application, it actually asks our participant to explain how they address each of the following provisions. And typically, this has been provided a very simple statement, which just explains whether or how the current policies, procedures, or agreements address each of these, or how they will be modified to reflect each of these items. So one is, how does your organization obligate the users or those who might connect through you who have eHealth Exchange connectivity to comply with applicable law? So is this already a premise that's in the legal agreements that you have with other participating organizations, or how do you obligate those users who would actually use the eHealth Exchange Gateway connection to make sure that they comply with applicable law? Is that in current policies? Is it in an employment agreement, et cetera? The other expectation is that what mechanisms do you have in place to make sure that the participants who either connect to you or the clinical users, for instance, would cooperate with you as it relates to issues regarding the DRSA. So do you have, is it a policy or procedure? Is it baked into a legal agreement? It's usually a simple statement to explain that. One area where we know we've had to spend some time clarifying is there is an obligation that by signing the DRSA that users and participants who have access through your gateway would only submit or respond to data for a purpose that's permitted in the DRSA. These are more narrow than what is permitted in the HIPAA rules. And there are, for instance, a participant can submit or request records for treatment, payment, and operations, but there are constraints around those, and Steve will talk about that in more detail. Typically, in some instances, a number of applicants work with a vendor who already has obligated them to a set of rules of the road, which are limited to making inquiries or releasing information for treatment purposes only. That's very consistent with the DRSA, and so you could, for instance, if that's the situation that you're in, you might state that this is already obligated and implemented through rules of the road with your vendor or perhaps through an internal policy, for instance. There is an expectation that data may only be used and once it's received and incorporated in your system in accordance with the DRSA, and so the expectations there, Steve will talk about it a little later, is that is your policy consistent with this? And if so, just stating how that's supported. The area where we've seen that there has traditionally been questions and there will certainly be changes to policies or agreements is as it relates to the breach notification requirements and the DRSA. And while I won't preempt the more in-depth discussion that we'll have here shortly about how breaches are defined, but there is an expectation that if there is a compromise to the connection for your eHealth Exchange connection that and that that be reported with 1 hour or 24-hour time frames. So again, this is an area where if you are an intermediary or a state or you are a community HIE and you have other organizations who participate and who actually connect through you to the eHealth Exchange, this is something that would definitely need to be flowed down very specifically into those legal agreements. And in terms of if you're a health system, for instance, there may be some analysis you might want to do with your security officer and your IT group to identify when this a breach would be triggered. And we'll talk a little bit about the scenarios that were contemplated against, very, very narrowly defined. And in that instance, there may need to be a new policy that's developed or an existing policy that's revised to reflect breaches that specifically pertain to the connection to the eHealth Exchange. And then finally, and this one we found to be fairly standard course because it does align with HIPAA, is what mechanisms do you have in place to make sure that the digital certificates that we provide to you, and as well as any passwords or measures that they have to gain access to the gateway, are appropriately secured. So I'll pause there. I'll turn it back to Steve, and we'll address, again, questions at the end.
Okay, thanks, Marianne. So we're gonna roll forward, and I'm going to cover the next set of slides relatively briskly so that we have time to talk about breach and some of the other points. This is where, if you've not ever picked up the DRSA, a lot of this, frankly, is going to maybe go over your head. But that I apologize for that, but I think if you've read the DRSA, it'll make a little bit of sense to you. So autonomy principle. This is in section 6.01 of the DRSA, and basically what this says, this is a recognition that participants have their own access policies. And in fact, the DRSA says affirmatively participants shall have access policies. And so if there was someone that wanted to become a capital P participant and sign the DRSA and did not have any access policies, they would have to adopt those in order to comply with this requirement. Now, having said that, beyond the requirement that a participant have access policies, there's a recognition that those are going to vary across the board. Some of those are different interpretations of state or local legal provisions or tribal legal provisions, and I keep bringing that up because that tribal law is very important here in terms of eHealth Exchange. And there are a lot of healthcare providers that are governed by tribal law in the United States. So just in a different body of law that you don't encounter every day, but is particularly applicable in healthcare. So, but participants for all sorts of reasons have different access requirements and different permissions. And so the DRSA recognizes this and says, as a participant, you are expected, required to have access policies, but those can be of your own design, whatever works for your community. And other participants agree to respect that. And that might, in some cases, determine whether or not there is a information is actually exchanged among participants in response to a query or a request. Next slide, 21, identification and authentication. Two separate requirements, but they're very much intertwined. Section 6.02 of the DRSA says that a participant shall employ a process. So again, it's mandatory language. You shall employ a process to confirm the identity of your users. The DRSA doesn't try to tell you what that process is, but simply that you must have a process that will validate who your users are prior to issuing credentials. You're all doing that already. And so really, it's not a huge lift in terms of a new requirement that you're not complying with. And then similarly, in 6.03 of the DRSA, there is a requirement that the participant shall employ a process to authenticate users. And this is the idea of credentials and verifying that the user is the user before allowing them to transact message content. So, again, fairly basic concepts that the DRSA specifically incorporates, things that you're probably already doing. Certainly you are if you have your own HIO. Okay, slide 22, permitted purposes. We touched on this earlier. This is a snapshot graphic that I think nicely explains what the permitted purposes for eHealth Exchange are. And certainly starting at the 12 o'clock position on the chart and moving around the clock, treatment, okay, that almost everyone who is engaged in electronic exchange of information supports treatment as a permitted purpose. Payment activities of a healthcare provider, not necessarily something that every HIO in the country has agreed to do yet. Limited healthcare operations. Don't really have the time to go through the specific enumerated operations. They're in the DRSA, and they are a subset of the operations that are permitted under HIPAA. And this is one example where the permitted purposes under the DRSA for eHealth Exchange are more narrow than the HIPAA definition of healthcare operations. And intentionally so. Public health activities and reporting. Any purpose to demonstrate meaningful use. This was added in our last restatement. Very, very important to everyone. And then at the 11 o'clock position, uses and disclosures pursuant to an authorization. The best example of this would be SSA disability determinations. SSA being the very first federal agency to use eHealth Exchange on a widespread basis, and one of the key drivers, Kit Winter at the SSA, is chair of the coordinating committee, and along with VA, have been really the drivers behind eHealth Exchange since the inception. And all the SSA disclosures are authorization-based. And so that's one example, but absolutely not intended to be the only example. There are many authorization-based disclosures, and that's why they are included within the definition of permitted purposes. So, I do a lot of work with health information exchanges all across the country. I can tell you that these permitted purposes are certainly broader than many of my clients, but they are narrower than HIPAA. And in some ways, the eHealth Exchange adopted these permitted purposes as a way to stretch the environment a bit and promote the case for exchanging information for more than just treatment. And I think folks are folks are slowly starting to come around to that broader definition of permitted purposes, in part because of the need to find a financially sustainable platform now that their ARRA grants are running out or have already run out. Let's go on to slide 23, duty to respond for treatment. This is one that's often misunderstood. What this says is that if a participant allows their users to request data for treatment purposes, then that participant and those users have a duty to respond to requests from other participants for treatment purposes. Now, what it does not say is that you have to actually disclose the treatment data. It simply says you have to respond to a request. There are lots of reasons why a participant might choose not to send the treatment data that they have. But that's perfectly appropriate because they may, under applicable law, they may not be allowed to do that. And that is fine. But you have to provide some response. And I know that we are still working, I should say the coordinating committee is still working on a set of standardized responses. That's proven to be more challenging than I think most of us thought it would be. And so there will be at some point a set of standardized responses that exist. For now, I think folks are just creating responses that allow them to respond even if they can't send the information. And so that's what the duty to respond means. And I know that's been misunderstood a lot, and I think one that I know Marianne has answered hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. Now, participants are allowed to, but they're not required to, by the DRSA, respond to all other requests. Again, I think this is an example where the DRSA really tried to look forward, maybe many years, to where the puck was going to be. Not where it was 5 years ago, but where it was headed, and create a document that would not have to be completely rewritten as this became, frankly, more acceptable and more comfortable and in some ways more necessary. I think that's exactly what is happening. And obviously, if disclosing information is going to require a participant to be in violation of their applicable law or their access policies, remember the autonomy principle, then a participant doesn't have to disclose that. The DRSA is not creating a no-win situation for the participant. Okay, slide 24, consent and authorization. Basically, this simply says that it is the responsibility of the submitter to be sure that all the legal requirements for disclosing data have been met before they submit that information. This would include, but isn't limited to, any consents or authorizations that the submitter has to have under applicable law. The requester may not have that obligation, but the submitter might have that obligation, and therefore the burden is on the submitter to be sure that they've complied with all their requirements before they release the information. And in some cases, this is going to mean that a submitter is not going to be able to provide information. We wish that weren't the case, but it is the case. And I don't really think that we've had a convergence of law over the years that since we started working on this. If anything, we might have had a divergence of law, but as states have adopted new and different statutes to govern electronic exchange of information. So this is intended to not put the participant in the impossible position of either violating law or violating the DRSA. That's a non-starter. That's not going to support a trust community. So we will never put a submitter in that position. It squarely puts the burden on the participant to know what they can and can't do under their applicable law and under their access policies. When there is an authorization-based request, which is one of our permitted purposes, The requester has to send a copy of the authorization with the request for data. And SSA, again, is the best example. And the system was actually, the functionality was created to support this, so that the authorization signed by the patient who is applying for disability benefits accompanies that request. And that's a requirement. And it's not just an SSA, it's a requirement for any authorization-based disclosure. Now, if it's a treatment-based, if the requesting data is for the purpose of treatment, you don't have to send the authorization. It's not an authorization. That's not the authorization is not the permitted purpose. Treatment's the permitted purpose. And so we're not trying to further burden the efficiency of the exchange. We're simply saying if you're relying upon the authorization-based disclosure as your purpose for doing the transaction, then the authorization has to accompany it. If you're relying upon another permitted purpose, probably treatment, then you don't have to send that. Okay, let's move on to slide 25 real quickly. Submitter responsibilities. I think we've probably sort of covered this. So in the interest of time, I'm going to jump on to slide 26, future use of data. This is also one that has generated a lot of discussion and maybe even some confusion. So what the DRSA says is that once information has been transacted over eHealth Exchange and it is received either by the participant or by the participant's end user, and that information is incorporated into the participant or the end user system of records, then that information becomes the property of the recipient. So think about a lab result that is sent using eHealth Exchange from hospital A to hospital B through two health. Hospital A is a member of MedVirginia, and Hospital B is a member of the new Highmark HIE in Pittsburgh, which is not yet a participant, but soon will be. And there's a medical need to have that lab result transmitted. So Hospital A sends it out. It's a treatment-based request. Presuming that the law doesn't prohibit it or the access policies don't prohibit it, which they probably won't, then that lab result gets transacted through the specs of eHealth Exchange and goes through Highmark and then lands in the hospital in Pittsburgh. At that point, the end user, the hospital in Pittsburgh, will probably decide to incorporate that into its system of records because it probably was asking for that information because of a patient encounter, and it's going to want that information in its medical record in case there's ever any question later about what information did the provider have. So once that lab result gets incorporated into Hospital B's system of records, that information is then available to Hospital B to do with as they see fit based upon their applicable law and their policies and procedures. So what this means is that Hospital A cannot tag that information to say you can only use this, you can read it and then you destroy it. That would prove impossible for eHealth Exchange to operate if that were the case. Now, this has been the source of a lot of discussion, and we don't really have time to walk through all the scenarios, but suffice it to say that there are some cases, most notably information related to Part 2 providers for federally certified substance abuse providers, where there is a federal statutory prohibition on redisclosure, and any information that is sent must have a legend that it cannot be redisclosed. Well, first of all, that information isn't at this point flowing through eHealth Exchange because the SAMHSA Part 2 rules are so complex and, in Steve Gravely's opinion, onerous. And there have been a number of white papers that have been published on this in terms of how this is an impediment to health data exchange. But and I'm not throwing SAMHSA under the bus. But we know there are a number of work groups that are trying to solve that riddle. But even if that was transferred forward with the appropriate legend, that information might still be incorporated into Hospital B's system of records. It would simply have the same duty it has today. It can't redisclose that because there's a federal law that says it can't. So again, eHealth Exchange is not imposing that requirement. It's simply the applicable law that Hospital B is subject to, in this case, the Part 2 rules. So, it's complicated, but it is solvable. Okay. With that, let's move on to slide 27. We're beginning to encroach on our Q&A time, and I want to try and respect that. So I want to spend some time talking about breach, and then I'll quickly finish up. So, yes, we have a comprehensive breach notification provision in the DRSA for obvious reasons. As I said, it was the boogeyman in the room that everybody was appropriately worried about and was the one thing that could have killed eHealth Exchange before it even got started. We addressed that, and I think we successfully addressed it, by doing a couple of things. We have very robust breach notification requirements in the DRSA, but they are robust for a very narrowly defined event. And so what you see on slide 27 is the definition of a breach is the unauthorized acquisition, access, disclosure, or use, that will look pretty familiar to you from HIPAA, of message content while transacting such message content. That's in red. And that is what narrows the scope of the DRSA breach universe. And so you'll see that a couple of examples of what a breach does not include these, and this is actually in the definition. It does not include any unintentional acquisition, access, disclosure, or use of message content by an employee or an agent of a participant if that unintentional acquisition was made in good faith and within the scope of their duties, and the information is not further acquired, access, disclosure, used by that individual. And two, any acquisition, access, disclosure, or use of information that was not directly related to transacting message content. So, what do those mean? What those mean is incidental disclosures that occur in good faith by the employer, agent of a participant or a participant user in the course of their job are specifically not breaches under DRSA. They might be breaches under HIPAA, but they are not breaches under DRSA. And if there is an event that results in acquisition, access, disclosure, or use at the participant level, but it wasn't directly related to a transaction, that's also not a DRSA breach. It may be a HIPAA breach. It is not a DRSA breach. And so really what we are not trying to do and what the DRSA absolutely does not do is to somehow impose on every participant that signs the DRSA the obligation to report to the coordinating committee every breach or potential breach that a participant has in their world. It absolutely doesn't do that. In fact, the coordinating committee does not even want, doesn't have the jurisdiction to deal with those. All the coordinating committee has the jurisdiction to do is deal with activities that occur through eHealth Exchange under the DRSA. And the coordinating committee has been extremely determined to not expand its jurisdiction for reasons that I'm sure are obvious to everyone on this call. And so a participant is very, very likely, I would almost say guaranteed, to have a HIPAA breach that where it must do some type of notification either to its exchange partners, maybe its state officials, maybe the secretary under the final rule provisions. But it's not a DRSA breach because it had nothing to do with the actual transaction of message content. So that's where the DRSA definition of breach is infinitely more narrow than the HIPAA definition of breach. Now, having said that, and let's look at slide 28, for that very narrow set of circumstances, where there would be a DRSA breach. Something happens related to the transaction of message content. The reporting obligations are extremely robust. Page 28, and I know this, when people have looked at this, you know, they have really been concerned about their ability to comply with this. I think that's lessening as we go through time. But within 1 hour of a participant becoming aware of a suspected breach, now again, this is not a HIPAA breach, this is a DRSA breach, so very narrow bandwidth, but within 1 hour of a participant becoming aware of a suspected breach, they must notify the coordinating committee and they must notify other impacted participants. And the DRSA actually describes the type of information that needs to be shared. And then within 24 hours of a confirmed breach, again, not a HIPAA breach, a DRSA breach, but a confirmed breach, then there is additional information that has to be provided. Now, this is really, really important. The difference between the 1 hour and the 24 hours could be a week. Within, you know, you become aware of a possible breach. A participant becomes aware of a possible breach, a possible DRSA breach. Boom, they're on the one-hour clock to notify the coordinating committee and whoever, whichever participant might be affected. At that point, the participant is going to begin to implement its own internal breach reporting infrastructure, and everybody has them now. Whatever it is you do, you will begin to implement that. It might take you a day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, whatever it takes you to confirm. Once you've done that, within 24 hours of having confirmed that a DRSA breach occurred, then you have to notify the CC. This has now been elevated to a confirmed DRSA breach. Here are the steps we've taken to mitigate, and here is our corrective action plan. And so I hope that that helps to clarify. We don't expect everybody to do this within 24 hours. These are different thresholds. And also, this is only for a DRSA breach, not a HIPAA breach. Now, just by way of history, the 1 hour and the 24-hour were inserted at the specific request of our federal partners, and particularly that the chief technology officers for some of the major federal agencies, because under U.S. CERT and some of the other bodies that the federal agencies report to, that's the requirement. And so this wasn't simply made up out of thin air. It was put in at the specific request of our federal partners. But it is, you know, we've done everything we can to try to make it reasonable. And as far as I know, and there have been a couple of incidents that have occurred, but this reporting regimen has not proven to be unworkable or onerous on any of the participants in real practice. Okay, real quickly, I'm going to wrap up. Self-auditing capability, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. And again, most people have that in place already now. Allocation of risk, this is really important. As you might imagine, the legal group spent months arguing about this. It was the second biggest boogeyman in the room, again, for very good reason. And it's still a huge issue in the field of electronic data exchange. Basically, what the DRSA says is everybody is responsible for themselves. And when you join the eHealth Exchange, you're responsible for your own conduct, and you're responsible for the consequences of your own conduct. And if you cause harm, then you are responsible for that. Now, I'll be the first to admit that if and when this ever happens, there will probably be disagreements among the participants about who is responsible for what. We have a dispute mechanism in place to help address that, and if that fails, folks can go to court, and the courts can decide. So I'm not naive enough to think that this will never be contested or debated. It certainly will, but essentially this allocates the risk where we think it belongs, which is to the person that breaches their duty. As you have seen, if you've read it, there are no indemnification provisions in the DRSA. There are no hold harmless provisions in the DRSA. And that the reason for that is very simple. Our governmental partners, both at the state level and at the federal level, are prohibited either by statute or by constitution from indemnifying private parties. And so that was actually a fairly easy issue. It was really not something that ever got much attention because our governmental partners said we can't do it, and we all agreed that unilateral indemnification wasn't fair, and so we simply don't have it in the DRSA, and that's why. I'd love to spend some time on reps and warranties, but you know what? I'm just going to scan them quickly and see if there are any that I want to point out to you, and then I'm going to stop and we're going to open the floor for questions. Probably the most important one is bullet number two. There's been a lot of confusion about this too. What the DRSA says in a couple of different places is that the participant that signs the DRSA makes a representation and warranty that what they are sending is an accurate representation of what they have. So let's go back to the lab result. What this really means is that the participant is agreeing that they have not altered that data. They have not changed the lab result. They're not saying the lab result is correct. They're not saying anything about the accuracy of that lab result. They're not saying anything about the medical efficacy or utility of that result. They're not doing any of that at all. What they're simply saying is, I am representing to my exchange partners that I have systems in place to accurately map and transmit the information that I receive, and specifically disclaim any liability for the accuracy of that information. As you might imagine, participants do not want to become the insurers of whether a lab result is correct or not. And so that's a very important point in terms of what the DRSA says and what it does not say. There are also disclaimers for if there are failures of infrastructure. Participants are not responsible for that. And data is provided as I said before. So, I mean, those are the key reps and warranties. There are others. And with that, though, I'm going to stop since it is now 3:17 by my clock and to try and provide some time for Q&A. Marianne, I'm going to hand it back to you.
Thanks, Steve. We know we've been receiving a couple questions here and during the chat section. Jen, Rosas, do you want to give folks the instructions for how to unmute for questions?
Sure. If you have a question, just press *6 on your phone, and you will be asked to confirm that you want to go ahead and ask a question. So we'll be entering Q&A mode.
Okay. First, Steve, we have a question here that was sent. Is the DRSA required by all participating organizations, or would all participating organizations sign it, or their vendor, or both?
Just the participating organization. The vendor really doesn't meet the definition of a participant. They're licensing their technology to the participant, and it's the participant that will be deploying that technology to support their exchange activity. And I do appreciate that. I've given a very simple and straightforward answer. I do appreciate that the world is more complicated and that roles are becoming more blurry. But we're trying to not impose on technology vendors the responsibility of complying with requirements that were really designed and intended to apply to the organizations that are managing the data sharing network, in this case the HIE or the HIO or whatever label you put on it.
Great. And then also there was another question with respect to the DRSA flowdown provision, specifically Section 15.04, which pertains to the agreements with participant users. And that section outlines that at a minimum that what those valid and enforceable agreements or policies need to include. And the question was, are there other things throughout the DRSA that should also be flowed down that aren't listed here? So, for instance, I think it was in Section 12.02, it talks about privacy and security and the requirement for disciplinary action. I don't think that was in the list of items in Section 1504. Do you, any insight on how broadly folks should look in the DRSA to figure out what needs to be baked into the flow down provisions?
Well, yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I think that 1504 and 1505 have sort of become referred to as the flow down provisions, but the questioner is absolutely correct. There are other sections of the DRSA that that arguably would have to be flowed down by the participant to their users, and some of that is going to be dependent upon the technology platform that the participant is using. In some models, the participant never touches the information and truly is a mere conduit. I don't mean to denigrate the role of the participant, but is really a conduit of information. And in that case, there are some other provisions that the participant, at least if I were legal counsel for the participant, I would recommend that they flow those down to their sub-participants or their users. Because, you know, I wouldn't want my client to sign a document that they had absolutely no ability to perform. And so I would definitely want to flow those down. Now, in other models where the technology model is different and the HIO is much more involved in the data flow and management, then, you know, perhaps the participant isn't going to need to flow that down. That's really going to be a case-by-case basis. And that's actually the reason that the work group did not create a section called flowdowns and try and list everything in there, because even back then, and I think the world has gotten even more complicated since the DRSA was first conceived, there was a recognition that there would be all sorts of different models for HIOs, and that we wanted to try and create a document that would accommodate those different models. And so it is an excellent question. And even though the DRSA doesn't say this anywhere, I think every participant needs to fully understand their responsibilities and then decide, in addition to the requirements in 1504 and 1505, what additional things should they be flowing down in their particular case to their participants or their users.
Great. Why don't we open it up now, Jen? Is there anybody who would like to raise a question?
I don't have anyone else right now, but we do have a couple more questions. Let's see. There's a question. If there's a requirement like SSA for HIPAA, where one state requires an authorization to make eligibility determination, is there a transaction profile that can be followed for the state to send the authorization along to the other entity being asked to disclose?
Well, if I understand what that is being asked, is there a way technically in the technical specifications to send along a copy of the authorization for a request for records? Eric Heflin, do you want to address that one, if you're available?
Marianne, Eric has had to get off the line.
Right. Well, my understanding is yes, that is built into the technical specifications to support that capability. It's supported in production today for the Social Security Administration use case, where they basically indicate in the request that an authorization was obtained.
Okay. Let's see. We have another question here. How is reasonably cooperate defined?
Yeah, okay, Sorry, Jennifer. I'll take that one. That's a term that's used, I know, in 1504 and 1505 and probably elsewhere. It is not a defined term. And the reason it's not a defined term is because it's one of those concepts that evolves over time. So the idea here is that we wanted to be sure that participants and then their downstream partners, whether they're end users or participant organizations, hospitals, health systems, whatever, that essentially there was a requirement that there be some level of cooperation in order to deal with issues that come up related to eHealth Exchange. You know, you see this in a lot of agreements. Sometimes there's a separate section, a cooperation clause section. Sometimes that language is extremely extensive. The work group talked about that a lot and decided that that was going to be counterproductive because the business and legal and technical environment of eHealth Exchange was evolving so rapidly that that we could not foresee all the nuances of what cooperation might entail. And so we intentionally did not define the term reasonable cooperation. We simply left it to be a facts and circumstances test. Some people have read that to mean commercially reasonable, and I think that's probably a fair label to put on it. You know, without getting too much in the legalese, when you talk about cooperation in business agreements, you generally divide the world into commercially reasonable efforts and best efforts, quote, best efforts, which and best efforts pretty much means you do everything possible, whereas commercially reasonable means you do, you know, sort of what's more normal and routine. And those are actually, those aren't defined. The courts have defined those standards over a couple of hundred years of case law. And so the DRSA leverages off of that and uses this reasonable cooperation standard and leaves it somewhat fluid for the parties to sort out if and when it's ever needed. So, hope that helps.
Okay, Aaron, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah, thank you very much, Steve and Marianne. Steve, I think you did a great deal of sharing around the definition of a breach. And I just have a question that may or may not be easy to answer. When we have a transaction between two participants, does the reportability under the DRSA for a breach end once the receiving entity has the data? When does the transaction end that it's no longer something that if there were a breach related to that particular piece of PHI, I would no longer have to come up to the coordinating committee and say, here's this breach? Is there an end to that, or is it just whether or not data that I received from some other entity is ever involved in a breach? Could you drill down on that a little bit more?
Yeah, good question. Marianne and I have not rehearsed this, and so if we come up with different answers, you know, it'll be interesting. I don't think we will, but I would say that, you know, the definition of breach in the DRSA is related to that particular transaction of message content. So once it is received and incorporated into the recipient's system of records, that it's no longer a transaction. It is, yep. And so if, say, you know, 2 hours later, 2 weeks later, 2 months later, that recipient has a HIPAA breach, that would not, simply because some of that might involve information that was transacted over eHealth Exchange, that would not trigger any reporting obligation to the coordinating committee.
And this is Marianne. I would completely agree that's consistent, and I'm glad it is consistent with the guidance we've been giving people.
That's really
I think it makes a lot of rational, you know, makes sense to me.
So on that note, this is actually a good guidance point, is if you think about the types of instances that would be reportable, it really does relate to the transaction and the movement of the data itself. And if you talk to your information security group, one of the risk scenarios that's been contemplated is if there's a man in the middle who intercepts the transmission or compromises it somehow. So if you look at the very, very narrow circumstances, and particularly if you look at the exceptions and the definition of breach, it's probably going to be something that's more or less detected by an IT or security group that's monitoring than by misuse of connectivity by an end user, as an example.
Yeah, I think that's a good example. I think that's right. But certainly it could be, you know, it could be an end user that was trying to get information But I think you're right, Marianne. I think today that's much less likely to be the case. You know, 5 years from now, who knows? But we, you know, we're just today. I think that is probably the classic scenario of what is likely to constitute a reportable breach. You know, as of June of 2013.
Well, I know we're nearing close on time. Actually, I think we're up on time. Well, Steve, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon and for everyone participating and for your great questions. I imagine you might have questions that come up that arise after this. Please don't hesitate to reach out to our team. We are in the process of developing a set of frequently asked questions and, again, additional guidance. And if there is an interest in maybe future sessions for open Q&A with respect to the DRSA, we're certainly happy to do so. So thank you all very much, and have a great day.
Bye now.